between that point and that point. And because they've been sleeping, they haven't been involved in any backbiting or anything else, right? However, they have missed also the spirit of the fast here. Because the intent behind it, why it's called fast, I mean, is that we are to experience something of hunger. We are to struggle with our desires for food, drink. This is part of the fast, desire for sex. These are to gain control over these desires, because these are the most powerful desires which drive human beings, drive them to all kinds of crimes. So this fasting period is to help us to gain control. So if we're sleeping the whole time, where is the control? And furthermore, by fasting, you also realize that there are people who are experiencing these pangs of hunger, which is not by choice. You are choosing not to eat, where they have no food. So this is supposed to also bring alive in you some kind of consciousness, sympathy and empathy for those people who are without. And this should drive you to be generous, to try to share some of what you have with others. So if you're not feeling any hunger because, you know, you've eaten a big meal when you break the fast, you eat a big meal before you go into the fast and you sleep all day, then, again, the essence of the fast there, though you have fulfilled the letter of the law, the ritual, by the spirit being missing, it becomes meaningless, useless. Yeah, also. But I mean, you could say even maybe that such a person, because they're concerned with the ritual, they will wake up at lunchtime and make their prayer. But again, it's the same thing even with the prayer. Allah says in the Quran, "Inna salah tanha anil fahsha wal munkar," that salah prevents us from evil speech and evil deeds. You know, prayer, this regular prayer, this is what it's supposed to do. But you have people who will be praying five times a day, but, you know, in their lives they're using curse words, you know, and just like the common people here, every second word is a curse word. For a Muslim, this is not supposed to be coming off his tongue, his or her tongue. Curse words, you know, foul language, this is not supposed to be, for a Muslim, it is just, if it is coming, then it means your prayer is useless. It is not having the effect that it was supposed to have. If you're praying and you're cheating people and you're lying and you're taking people's property and stealing, etc., then again, your prayer is useless prayer. Obviously, you have missed something of the prayer. The spirit of the prayer is not there. You may be going through the movements, the motions, but you may as well be doing aerobics or, you know, something else. So, the spirit has to be there. And that is brought to life by sincerely dedicating whatever act of worship you are doing to God. And the second principle is that the acts of worship that we do, for it also to be acceptable, it has to be done in accordance to the way of the prophets of God. So I'll just stop at this point and give you an opportunity now to share some comments you may have or raise some questions that you'd like to raise, inshallah.
You mentioned about the ladies covering themselves decently. What about the men?
The men also. There is, our sister was just mentioning about the covering of the ladies. There are also guidelines with regards to the dress of the men. And it is something which, unfortunately, most of the times when, you know, lectures are given which have to do with dress, the emphasis is always placed on the women. And even, you know, in the raising of children, for example, here in this society, you know, the girls are always required to do these things, and then the boys, it's okay. You know, they can just be like everybody else. But in fact, you know, Islam does set aside guidelines for male dress as guidelines were set aside for female dress. They're not the same in the sense that the man is not required to cover everything except for his face and hands. However, there are requirements which have to do with the type of dress, that the male dress not be tight, you know, jeans, tight pants, which show the shape of the private parts. This is not permissible in Islam. It's considered unacceptable. And for one even to pray in such a dress is not considered acceptable, because one of the requirements for formal prayer is that one cover one's privates. And that covering which reveals the privates is not considered to be covering from Islamic perspective. And also in terms of the garments, male garments, they, in terms of the pants or dress that they may be wearing, it should not hang below the ankles. You know, this hippie style of letting the clothes unnecessarily drag, being long, you know, this type of, this dress is, have been prohibited from the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You know, you wear the, that should be a part of the dress of the Muslim male, should be known. And he should, part of his dress for a Muslim male is his beard. And it's part of the dress of the Muslim male, distinguishing him when he leaves his home, when he is in society, that he grows his beard and he trims his mustache. This is a basic. So, and it is as much compulsory for a man to grow his beard as it is for a woman to cover her hair. You know, and this is one of the things the brothers need to realize too, that, you know, they may be insisting that their wives cover themselves, but they are themselves not, you know, fulfilling some of the requirements of Islam, which is that of growing the beards themselves. You know? And the idea, in any case, is that the Muslim male should be distinct in a society where he is amongst non-Muslims. He should be distinct. It's not to say that he's going to, you know, dress himself up in such a way he appears like a clown. You know, I'm not suggesting that. But that he, in terms of his mode of dress, he is not a fashionable person. In the sense that, you know, when the fashions change, he's got a wardrobe filled with dresses and, you know, shirts and pants and shoes. And when the fashion next year comes, he, this stuff he does no longer wear, he buys another set. No, this is considered to be wastage, squandering of one's wealth. And in Islam, this is prohibited. You know, God says in the Quran, إِنَّ الْمُبَذِّرِينَ كَانُوا إِخْوَانَ الشَّيَاطِينَ. Those who are spendthrift, they are squandering in their wealth. They are brethren of the devils. This is a very serious description. So a Muslim is not one who buys, uses his wealth moderately. This is he knows that the wealth which has been given to him has been given to him by God. It's not something that he's free to do anything that he wishes with. So he can just buy whatever he feels like and waste it here, there, whatever, burn it up in smoke, etc. No. This is a responsibility which he will be asked about on the Day of Judgment. He has to use it moderately and for the benefit of both himself and for the society, not for their harm. Further comment or question?
Excuse me, brother. You were saying that for us Muslims, we believe in the miracles of Prophet Moses and Prophet Jesus, like raising the dead. I got friends, Christians, who believe that Jesus is the Son of God and Holy Ghost at the same time. To them, they are miracles, God miracles. So it's like, how do you see this point from
Islamic point? Well, the miracles which have been associated with Prophet Jesus in the New Testament, you can find all of them in the Old Testament. Bringing to life the dead is there in the Old Testament. In the case of Jesus, he brought to life a man who had died, was a physical body which was there. You have one of the prophets of the Old Testament described as bringing to life bones. Person who had gone to bones. You know, there was just a skeleton there and came back to life. You know. So what it is that all of the various miracles that have been ascribed to Jesus, which we as Muslims do believe in, these have been performed by the prophets of old. And this is not evidence that Jesus is in fact God. I mean, by you showing them that the earlier prophets, you can get the references, I don't have them off the top of my head to quote, but if you'd like to get them, I could get them for you. You can show them that, in fact, okay, if you say that Jesus is God because he brought to life this dead person, well, what do you say about that prophet who brought to life people who, you know, such a person was bones? Does that make him God also? No, well, they don't believe he's God. So obviously, that miracle is not proof of him being God. And of course, from the Islamic perspective, we believe that whenever prophets did miracles, and they did so in the name of God. You know, they made it clear to the people that they, it's not themselves who were doing it, but this was God who was doing it through them. You know, this was to convince the people that they were messengers of God, not that they were God. They didn't call people to their own worship.
Yes. I got your point there, but the thing is that when we question the Christians about the basic essence of faith, that is Trinity, for us it's like, doesn't make sense. But what I normally got answered from them is like, these are miracles of Jesus, God to them. It's like, if he can raise up the dead, why can't he himself be God?
Well, as I said to you, for that argument, if you show them the prophets of old who also did it, if they use that as the basis of him being God, then they will have to accept those earlier prophets as also being God, which they don't accept. So by you showing them that, that part of the argument will cease. Because their belief that he is God, really, it is not hinging only on that. There are other points. So what you do is you narrow it down to really what is the point. It's not the miracle, let's go to something else. Well, they say, okay, some say, well, it was because he was born without a father. Okay, we say, okay, well then Eve was born without a mother. What does that make her? Adam was born without father or mother. Well, what does that make him? Okay, it's not about whether he had a father or mother or not. Okay, let's go to something else. So you keep cutting it down to really what is the essence? What is the basic point on which that whole belief that Jesus is God is based? Okay? And after you have found that point, then what you can do to help to clarify for them to understand, you can take them to the Catholic Encyclopedia. I'm sure they have it here in the university library, you know, and other encyclopedias like Encyclopedia Britannica, etc., and show them the evolution of the belief. The belief that Jesus is God is something which evolved. That there were many, many early Christian groups that did not believe this, who used the same texts to prove that Jesus was not God. Even today, you have groups amongst Christians, you know, who consider themselves Christians, though the mass of Christianity don't consider them to be Christians. But, you know, people like the Jehovah's Witness and others, who don't believe that Jesus is God, based on the same texts of the New Testament that are used by other Christians to hold that he is God. The Unitarian movement, you know, has historically depended on certain texts from the Gospels which indicate that Jesus was not God. So see, what happens then is that you find in the Gospels, you know, material of two types. Material which seems to indicate he definitely wasn't God, and then some material which seems to indicate that he might have been God. Some of that material which tends to indicate that he might have been God or which spoke towards the Trinity, modern biblical scholarship has identified as being interpolations. So you find even in some modern translations of the Bible that these verses have been dropped. because they were not found in the earliest of the Greek manuscripts. So, as I said, one, you can try to narrow them down to really what is the essence, what is the main reason, and then if you can take them to the library and let them read for themselves about the history, the evolution of this belief that Jesus is God. And there's a book, actually, it was written in England by 10 British theologians. It is called The Myth of God Incarnate by Hicks. It's probably here in the library also, by Hicks. The Myth of God Incarnate. This is, it has 10 chapters, each written by leading scholars, biblical scholars, in England, showing, bringing all the documentary evidence. It's very academic. You know, for the average person to read it, it's a bit difficult, you know, but it's very academic. But they bring the evidence, historical evidence, so and so, showing you the evolution of the idea. And their view is that the belief that Jesus was God incarnate is in fact not the teaching of Jesus and is not essential to belief in Jesus, to be a true follower of Jesus. That's what one would conclude from what they're stating. Some of them actually state that within their essays.
Try and convince somebody that that was. I am a Christian by my faith, and I respect your faith. I think that if there's going to be any sort of communication between us, and I would hope that in the future that we have, it's like people speaking different languages. There's some things you can't interpret. And I think, you know, there's some areas when you speak about Christian faith that you don't understand, same as when you speak about the Muslim tradition, I cannot understand. And I think that by trying to wash down the Christian idea and saying you can explain it through looking at the evolution of ideas, I don't think you can do that, because you're talking about faith.
Well, you know, personally, let me just say that I was born and raised a Christian, so I do have an idea of, you know, what Christianity is, at least through the Presbyterian and Anglican trend of Christianity, you know, and as such, not only that, but also having read and studied Christianity myself, you know, and having read and studied Islam, that I feel that it is valid to make comparisons. I was giving advice to one of the brothers here who ends up in discussions, because discussions between Christians and Muslims is something inevitable.
But the discussion should be rich, because you have we have respect for each other's traditions. It's not a matter of, I think, one of the biggest problems in the Christian tradition today is the proselytization that goes on. When you have a lot of Christian groups who are out proselytizing and trying, and there are Christian groups on this campus, and I'm a Catholic, that they will try and convince students to be Christians, and they will say that, you know, they don't like Muslims. And I think that's one of the biggest shames in the Christian tradition. But if we look to the richness of Muslim faith and Christian faith, I think that, you know, what I would be saying to the student there is that this is what Christians believe, and it's their right to believe that. It's not. I think one of the richest things about the Muslim faith, and this is what Muhammad has shown me, is that we can dialogue well and have great respect for each other without any need to say one has to change.
Well, see, the question of having to change, of course, this is something which is personal. You know, if one feels that one has to change, then that's when one makes the change. But in terms of dialogue, in terms of discussion, the discussion is useful to the degree that it has some benefit coming out of it to both of us. Part of that benefit is in understanding what each other's beliefs are. You know,
well, I don't understand that. I'm happy with that, but don't try and wash Christianity the same as I would hope that Christians don't try and wash Muslim faith. And I know some Christians do, and I'm sorry that they do that. But I just think.
I don't know if it's really washing. I'm saying to understand what Christian faith is, to suggest that you one go and read the historical development, this is very reasonable. I mean, how can one understand without understanding the historical roots? I mean, how can you understand even your own faith yourself if you have not understood where that faith came from, where the ideas came from? I mean, this is one of the things in Islam in general, that it encourages people to question and to understand and to research and to, you know, not just to accept things blindly. Because blind faith, when we look at this situation, because we as believers, believing in God, we believe in God, and we would hope for paradise, you know, for ourselves. And if we believe that what we are following is in fact a way to paradise, and if we see others around us who seem, according to what they are practicing, headed for hell, I mean, is it not your duty as a human being? Wasn't that what prophets did? Try to call the people to the correct path. So if you have, you see, the thing is that there is no harm in you trying to explain to me why the way of your faith is the best way or is the correct way. There's no harm as long as you don't do it in an oppressive manner, whereas you don't give me a chance to dialogue with you and discuss and to come to understanding, where I'm pushing it down your throat or I'm holding a sword over your head. I mean, this is when we say this is not really dialogue anymore. But for you to express your view, why and so, for me to hear and see your view, and then for you to see my view, you know, why historically, all the different things involved in it, this is the search.
And
this is
also revelation from God, isn't it? Because, I mean, without Muhammad, you wouldn't have Muslim faith.
Yes, revelation, yes.
And the same with us. Without my belief in Jesus Christ, I wouldn't have my Christian faith. So there's some area that we're not going to come to grips with, and we're not going to be able to resolve, and that's the beauty about the differences.
No, but you see, once you've decided that we're not going to be able to come to grips with, and we're not going to be able to resolve, then you have doomed us to be. Well, if you said we're not going to come to grips with, we're not going to be able to resolve.
Understand it. I mean,
no, see, that's what you're doing. You're putting your barriers. What I'm saying is that no, we can come to an understanding. We can resolve it. If we sit down and discuss and look at the issues and so on, so why not?
I think that's the difference. I don't think there's a problem that you're a Muslim and I'm a Christian. The only thing I was a bit concerned about was one of the things I respect about most about the Muslim faith is that there doesn't seem to be this proselytization. You seem very
open to discussion.
Open to discussion, no, but you. I know a few Muslims, but you don't have the need that a lot of other faiths do, and unfortunately a lot of other Christians have, to go out and
win converts.
Yeah, and you don't seem to do that, but just I thought when you were talking then, it just sounded a little bit like that to me, and that's sort of...
No, this was our friend here was involved in discussion, and he said that when they reach a certain point, he didn't know what to do to help to clarify for them, to help to show them. So I gave him, you know, a channel, which is an academic channel, to follow. But the idea that, you know, for us to discuss and to come to an understanding, this is something which we need to do because there is a problem. There is a problem because, as the Catholic, as the Catholic Church teaches, those who are not Catholics, and because it's not even just a question between Catholics and Muslims, the Catholics and other Christians, those who are not Catholics, who have not been baptized and fallen within that system, are not going to paradise.
You're talking Vatican I, that was 1921 that was stated,
mm-hmm.
And I'm ashamed to say this, but in the Vatican documents that came out in 1921, it said that outside the Catholic Church there is no salvation. But in 1960, there was a Vatican Council and we had Pope John the 23rd, and he spoke about multi-faith, he spoke about within the Christian dialogue, but he obliterated that statement. And I would hope that none of you ever hear a Catholic say that again. But unfortunately, I've heard a priest say it last year in a parish church down at Tugan. So, but for the most part, that has been obliterated from churches' teaching, that I think any Catholic would say that there is salvation for everyone. And my belief is there is salvation for anyone, no matter what faith they are, agreeing with you that so long as they live righteously with that faith and action together, no matter if they're Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, it doesn't matter.
But the church, but Christianity though, right, as a whole, I'm not talking about your personal faith now, Christianity as a whole does hold that those who do not accept Jesus as their personal savior will not enter paradise.
A lot of my friends would be on my side, and I would speak a lot for the Catholic Church. I know there's elements that don't, and I think the Catholic Church has made some terrible mistakes.
The official policy.
No, it's not. The official policy, if you read the Vatican II documents on ecumenism and multi-faith, you will see it there. Now, you read it.
Even outside of the Christian?
Even outside the Christian faith. And the whole idea is when we went into countries and tried to make people become baptized, that's gone. It really has.
Mm.
You read Vatican II.
Okay, but, you know, still, as I said, even if Catholics have made these modifications, and you said this is between Vatican I and Vatican II, which is also something that somebody should reflect on. I mean, how it is that the church, which was representing the believers for so many hundreds of years, what year was Vatican I?
1920s.
Vatican II is?
About 60s.
Okay, 1960s. You know, 40 years passed. I mean, that Vatican I, that statement was made, a statement of, as the leadership of the faith, expressing
that. The worst thing that the church has ever done.
Anyway, I mean, these are among the questions that we should look at anyway. But as I said, even in the case of Catholicism, if, as you stated here in Vatican II, this, you know, has been modified and so on, so when you go into many of the other Christian groups throughout Protestant sects, etc., you find there's a clear position that if you are not a Christian, you are going to hell. So, you know, on the basis of that, I mean, there is a problem. Because if one group of people are saying, if you're not a Christian, you're going to hell, another group of people are saying, if you're not a Muslim, you're going to hell, then we need to find a middle path here, find out, you know, really where we should be.
But don't lose. You know, it would be horrible if, and I know it's happened, you've got Anglican Jews. I think, you know, we don't want to compromise and give up Christianity, and you don't want to give up the richness of yours, but we need to be, have respect and learn from each other.
Yeah, well, respect is definitely the starting point, because if we don't have respect for each other, then we can't really dialogue. It becomes like, you know, preaching as opposed to discussion.
Thank you. All right, I think at this point of time we have to stop. I hope that we enjoyed the lecture and the discussion. There is one very important point. As a Muslim, in every unit of Salat, every day, we say, اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. Show us the straight path. So all of us should be all the time seeking to find the truth. Whatever we believe that we are in the truth path, and the right path, and the truth, we're still seeking more and more.
Guidance.
And this attitude of all of us should be, and I hope we take it in a friendly and brotherhood manner.
Sisterly.
And we thank all of you for coming. We thank Brother Bilal Phillips, and we thank also Sister who helped us to book the room. And we thank all the students who organized this. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum.